Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Russia, and we have here as our guest a journalist who spent quite a lot of time following events in Russia. His name is David Satter. He's a former Moscow correspondent of the Financial Times. He's also written extensively for the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. His articles have, in addition, appeared in other papers like the LA Times, the National Interest, the National Review, the New Republic, New York Review of Books, and the Washington Times. He's published two books on Russia. Those are Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union. It was published in 2001, and Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State, published in 2003. He's here visiting the University of Illinois. He's on campus this semester teaching a course on contemporary Russian politics and the media, and he will be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Foreign Languages Building, room 1080, talking about the Soviet Gulag. And we will talk at least in part about that here this morning, and perhaps talk about some other things, talk about contemporary Russian politics, talk a little bit about life in Russia after Putin, and maybe also what that means for relations between Russia and the United States. And as usual, we're open to questions. If folks would like to call in and join the conversation, they certainly can do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We just ask people to be brief if possible, just so we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, I'm very glad to be here.
When you talk about the Soviet Gulag, I'm sure that some people will understand that there what you're talking about is a system of prisons and work camps and mental hospitals that were constructed and used during the Soviet times as a way of dealing with people that the leadership considered to be undesirable, troublemakers, problematic, everything from true criminals to people who were political activists and who were challenging the political leadership. For those people who don't know anything about this or for whom that phrase, the Soviet Gulag, really doesn't have much meaning, just remind us, what is it that we're talking about?
Well, the term gulag comes from the Russian term "государственное управление по лагерям", which means "государство" is the state directorate for camps. Lager is camp in Russian, so you take the first part, "государство" and "lag", and you get gulag, and. It was quite a system. It was a system not only for punishing dissent, but also it was a system of forced labor. And this continued all the way through the Brezhnev period. Mm-hmm. It was not only criminals and dissenters who ended up in the Gulag. It was oftentimes ordinary citizens who, for the slightest infraction, were condemned and sent to a work camp for a couple of years to provide a certain amount of free labor for the state. It was integrated very much into the Soviet economy, and it was necessary in a centralized, inefficient economy which was run by command. You had to have some people who you could literally force to take the most unpleasant jobs because there were no incentives to get them to take them, and whose labor you could simply appropriate. That was the nature of the economic system that existed in the Soviet Union.
And how many people are we talking about?
Well, it depends. At various times it was different. Under Stalin, it was millions. Under Brezhnev, in fact, the gulag was smaller. But also, I think the figures are at the height of the Stalinist repression, something like 6 million people were in the labor camps. And under Brezhnev, the number was smaller, maybe 2 million, but there were two or three. But there were still a considerable number of people, even in the late Soviet Union, who were forced to work for the state without pay and under prison conditions. And, of course, their number included political dissenters as well. These people were kept in political labor camps, not in general labor camps. The vast majority of the prisoners were in the general labor camps. But nonetheless, the principle of forced labor was the same everywhere.
And what sort of work were the, were people doing in these places?
Oh, it varied widely. It could be some people would oftentimes perform some type of routine function for a neighboring factory, or they would work in construction. There would be a big construction project, and next to the construction project would be the labor camp with the barbed wire and watchtowers where the workers were marched back to their prison bunks after working all day on construction. It was a wide variety of things. It could be screwing in parts for some type of factories, usually very monotonous, very routine, very mind-numbing.
Mm-hmm. What I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about is how it is that the existence of the Gulag and the fact that people knew that it existed and that it would be possible for them to be sent there, how that fit in to the general kind of society that existed during the Soviet times, and how that was one of the tools that the Soviet leadership used as a means of social control.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, it was different in different periods. During the Stalin period, the fear of arrest was so pervasive that people literally were afraid to be late for work, to make a mistake at work, to say an unnecessary word or to express a free thought. The situation was better, of course, in the Brezhnev period. In the last years of the Soviet Union, there was relatively more liberal. People had more freedom to goof off at work, and they indulged themselves considerably under those circumstances, and also to express themselves up to a point in their own homes and with close friends. But nonetheless, even in the Brezhnev period, the fear of being arrested was a formidable a disincentive to express yourself freely or even to think, because if you can't express your thoughts, why develop them? And it was much easier in that situation simply to identify with the regime and with the dominant propaganda and to vocally express your loyalty. This was safe, it was advantageous, and it eliminated that awful feeling of risk that people inevitably had if they started to behave like true individuals capable of independent thought.
Yeah. So you first started reporting from Moscow when you were working for the Financial Times. This was in the mid-70s?
I went to Moscow for the Financial Times in 1976. I was quite young, and I've been writing about Russia and the Soviet Union ever since.
So you were there at the time when Gorbachev came along, and things, we had this very significant period of change as well. So you had some basis of comparison between what it was like then and what it had been.
Oh, absolutely. Because I lived for 6 years in the Soviet Union during the Brezhnev period, at the very heart of what the Russians began to call, after Brezhnev had died and Gorbachev took over, they called it the period of stagnation. In fact, it's a bit of a misnomer, because the period of stagnation was the period when the Soviet Union was at the pinnacle of its world power, and its influence was felt in every country of the world. But nonetheless, I was there during that period, and of course could see the huge difference that took place once the Soviet system began to be dismantled. Mm-hmm. Soviet system was always a very artificial system which went against basic human instincts, and it didn't take long, once the totalitarian control was loosened, for people to begin to behave more freely and for normal capitalist institutions to take root. And that's what happened. Today, of course, Moscow is unrecognizable by comparison with what it was in 1976 when I first came. Well, I was there earlier, but when I first came in as a correspondent, as a journalist.
Well, for those people particularly had grown up during the Brezhnev time, when Gorbachev came along and proposed this greater openness and greater freedom, how did they react to that, and how did they even know? How did they even start to think about how they were going to live and what they were going to do if their entire life and if their entire mindset was grounded in this earlier time?
Well, the mentality of the Soviet Union was based on control over information. And one of the things that Gorbachev did was that he authorized the policy of glasnost, in which everything that had been hidden about the Soviet past became public, and truthful information became available to Soviet citizens. And this had the effect of cracking the previous mentality, or at least discrediting it. And people realized that there was an enormous amount that they hadn't known. It's funny, when glasnost began, there were remarks, they began publishing in the newspapers articles about social problems that had long been concealed in the Soviet Union. And it was possible to hear a remark like the following. One woman said to another, you see what Gorbachev's reforms have brought us. Now we have prostitution. There was prostitution before, but it just wasn't written about. But once glasnost began, these social problems that had always existed began to be a matter of public knowledge. Mm-hmm. The Soviet people under Stalin, under Brezhnev, lived in an unreal world. They lived in a world of artificially constructed reality. And this was based on suppressing truthful historical facts, closing out the outside world, closing the borders so that people couldn't travel and see for themselves, jamming the foreign radio stations, and inculcating mind-numbing propaganda with the help of a monolithic press, radio, television, and press. So once there began to be cracks in that system, the irreality that the regime was imposing had to share the public space with a certain amount of reality, it created, of course, a crisis of consciousness and a moral crisis for many people who had believed the previous propaganda. But it was what eventually brought down the Soviet Union.
Well, if you look at that time, and you look at particularly this time when the official line of all the Soviet media was that Soviet Union was a workers' paradise and life was great for everybody and there was no crime and society moved along in an orderly way and there weren't social problems. Surely people must have known that that was a fiction because in simply looking at their own lives and the people that they knew, they must have known that in fact, for example, to cite the example that you did, people must have known that prostitution existed. And how many people could have been shocked when the story came out that there was prostitution? Certainly, people must have known that was there. And then all sorts of other things that officially the Soviet government denied did, in fact, exist.
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, if we go back to the example of prostitution, prostitution is usually hidden in any society. It isn't advertised. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in the West, people might have a tendency to underestimate the extent of prostitution or other social problems because these things are not advertised. They're not visible to the overwhelming majority of the population every day of their lives. And so, in fact, what a free press does in any country is it calls attention to all kinds of social problems that if we didn't have a free press, we might overlook or we might underestimate. So that's the first thing. The other is that the Soviet people enjoyed living in a world of illusions to some extent because it gave meaning to their lives. They enjoyed the feeling that they were citizens of the most progressive country in the world, that they were dedicated to building communism, that they were creating a new world for all of humanity, that they were the vanguard of the human race. It was a way of bolstering their identity and bolstering their self-esteem. And for many people, it was difficult to part with those illusions. So it's not true that people were hungry to get the truth. Once they got the truth, of course, it was a big shock. But living as they did under the previous regime, many Soviet citizens actually were rather happy. They were happy in their ignorance and in their lack of freedom.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Satter. He's a journalist who has been watching events in Russia and the former Soviet Union for a long time. He's former Moscow correspondent of the Financial Times. He has written extensively for the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, and his articles have appeared in other places as well, including LA Times, New York Republic, New York Review of Books, Washington Times. He's authored two books on the Soviet Union. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and is now spending some time this semester on campus of the University of Illinois teaching a course in contemporary Russian politics and the media. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. If you take a look at life in Russia, say compare the Brezhnev Russia with Gorbachev's Russia and Putin's Russia
and Yeltsin's Russia.
And yes, I guess we'd better also include Mr. Yeltsin. These four periods, and particularly thinking about say Yeltsin and after, and of that period, particularly thinking about the time that where we are now, and the what has become a commonplace that what Putin has done is that he's in a sense reversed everything that Gorbachev did, and that somehow he has taken Russia back to what it was like before the Soviet Union came apart. Is that in fact true?
Well, no, it isn't, because the Russia of today is still vastly different from the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. It's vastly more free. And just for example, Russians travel freely. Russia is part of the global economy. Consumer goods of all types are freely available in Russia, which was definitely not the case under the Soviet regime. People are able to express themselves more or less freely. The press, within certain limits, as long as they're careful not to be too inquisitive about who is stealing the country's wealth, can actually criticize and report quite a lot. And there are some very talented journalists in Russia, despite the fact that some of the bravest and most talented have been killed. So it's impossible to say, really, that Putin is taking Russia back to the Soviet period. What he's doing is despite the hopes of the world that Russia would emerge as a democratic country, he's constructing an authoritarian regime which has certain things in common with traditional Russian authoritarian regimes, including the Soviet Union. The lack of public participation in the political process, a basically one-party system, and most of all, the lack of respect for the individual and the lack of a deep conviction, which is the root, actually, of democratic societies, that the individual and his life have some value. That's what's missing. So in that sense, it is like the Soviet Union. But in other respects, it's quite different.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation, starting first with someone who's listening in down in Mount Vernon. Oh, sorry, this is Mount Vernon, Indiana. I'm thinking this would be Mount Vernon, Illinois. Mount Vernon, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have a couple of questions. I was interested in the social class aspect of Russia. Is there an obvious difference in social classes, and also the relationship that they have with China in this day and age? Could you expand upon that a little bit, please?
Well, on the question of differences in wealth and social classes, I think what we're seeing now is a huge disparity in wealth in Russia. The there's a small group of people who are super wealthy and who are conspicuous consumers beyond anything that, I think they're probably in the same league with the princes of the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. But then there's a kind of middle class that serves this plutocracy, and a very large proportion of the population that is either poor or desperately poor. So it's an unstable situation. I believe if I don't have the figures absolutely at my fingertips, but if I recall correctly, the top 10% or so of the population in Moscow in terms of income has 49 times the income of the bottom 10%. Now, I'm not sure if I'm right when I say 10% and 10%. I've got those figures somewhere, but the disparity in wealth between those at the top and those at the bottom is just enormous. And your other question concerns
relations with China.
Relations with China. Well, Russia is China's principal arms supplier. Now, there are some limits on what they're willing to sell to the Chinese. But in fact, they've made clear that they consider China a potential ally in certain respects. They conducted joint military exercises with the Chinese. Whether in the long run the Chinese consider Russia to be indispensable to their global plans is another matter. But for reasons of vanity, I think the Russian leadership tries to demonstrate that that they are not beholden to anyone, that they can carry out an independent foreign policy, that of course, the subtext to this is that it doesn't matter if it's in their interest or not, or if it's in if it's threatening in the long run to Russia itself. The important thing is to show that they can do what they want, and they can stand up to the United States. And a good way of doing that is, of course, making common cause in certain respects with China.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Your insight.
To stay very quickly with the economic issue, I think that the impression that I've gotten, and this connects with support for Mr. Putin, is that while what you say is true, is that a small number of people have become very, very wealthy, we have a significant number of people who are poor, but that the economic improvements in the country have been enough, and enough people are doing well enough better so that overall contributes to support for Mr. Putin. Is that generally true?
Yeah, I think it is. I always, during all the years that I visited and lived in the Soviet Union or Russia, I always thought of Russia as a very poor country with a very low standard of living. But that's not the case anymore. Now there's really a vibrant middle class, and there are many people who live at a European standard, and Moscow and to a lesser extent St. Petersburg have some of the aspects of modern European cities, Of course, this is the result of the boom in commodity prices, which Russia was the leading beneficiary of the world commodity boom. It doesn't one doesn't have to be an economic genius to benefit from a rise in oil prices that went from $9 a barrel in 1998 to almost $100 a barrel just recently. Mm-hmm. That's Russia's principal export, and of course they benefited enormously.
If it had not been for that kind of the kind of run up on oil prices that we've seen, particularly the past couple of years, would Russia have the kind of muscle that it does? Is that mostly derived from economic power, which mostly derives from the oil and gas resource that the country has?
Yes, I think so. I think that without the rise in energy prices, Russia would have faced a real crisis.
We're at our midpoint here. Again, questions are welcome as we continue to talk with David Satter. 333-9455 is our number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I do want to mention once again that he'll be giving a talk about the Soviet Gulag this afternoon beginning at 4 in room 1080 of the Foreign Languages Building on the U of I campus. That's 707 South Matthews. He is here spending time on the campus, sponsored both by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center and also the College of Communications. He is teaching a course this semester on contemporary Russian politics and the media. And questions welcome. Let's go on to another caller here, Champaign County, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. On this last subject of the economic comparisons, it's hard. One's hard put to make a simple comparison. I'm sure you can find an economist to say otherwise. But like I say, if you went quintile by quintile, perhaps the U.S. has a better distribution. I don't know. I'm just positing that. I'm not saying that's true. But the statistics, the raw statistics, are that the distribution of wealth is, you know, flips between here and Australia as far as what the most lopsided towards the wealthy are. So we don't really talk about having a kleptocracy here, but we might have one. But that's just a reflection on what you were just speaking about. It seems to me that we had this rapacious shock therapy during the Yeltsin era that yielded the blowback of during that period. People were nostalgic for the Brezhnev period. There were polls done that showed that people felt that they were doing better than they were during, you know, when wealth was being extracted and deals were being set and oil territory was being kleptoed, if you will. So it just seems that, you know, if shock therapy hadn't been in this disastrous reorganization hadn't gone ahead, that we might be in a different circumstance now. That's a bit of hindsight, and I just wanted your comment. And I have another comment too, which is just on the main thesis. And since I won't have a follow up, the czars had a system of exile that certainly wasn't as extensive, as drastic, and as horrible as the Soviet system did. But just as they had a secret service system that was par excellence, if you want to put it that way, they and the Russians and the Soviets did too. I'm not saying it's all down to the Russian character, but there's history there that predates the Soviet era. That I wonder whether you reflect on that when you talk about the Gulag, if you would.
Yeah, I don't know where we should begin, Chess. Probably as far as the shock therapy is concerned, a lot of people blame the shock therapy, so-called shock therapy.
That's what it was called at the time, sir.
Yeah, but the reality is that what the real problem was the absence of law. Even, you know, shock therapy versus there are various economic arguments that could have been made for shock therapy or for a more gradual approach. But what what was really critical and what was missing was the rule of law in Russia. And in the absence of that, the country was taken over by criminals. I think that the Russian people would have even supported economic shock therapy and a sharp fall in their standard of living if they had seen that the country was adopting genuinely democratic institutions and there was genuine rule of law and it was being administered and the economy was being administered fairly and in the interest of the entire population. But what happened was well-connected insiders used corrupt ties to the government to acquire great wealth and become, you know, billionaires literally in a matter of a few years. And this, of course, greatly alienated the Russian population, and with good reason. They felt that the economic wealth that had been created by the combined efforts of the entire population was being appropriated by a well-connected few. So I think that when we talk about the reform period, it's important to bear in mind that it was the lawlessness and the criminality that was the real core problem, not the choice of economic policies, which may have been wise or unwise, but in any case, under the circumstances in which they were carried out, were doomed to failure. As far as the roots in Tsarist Russia of Soviet practices, they're undeniable. And unfortunate inheritance from the Tsarist period was the tendency in Russia to view the individual as insignificant and the absence of rights. Under these circumstances, the communist regime, which was explicitly anti-traditional, anti-religious, anti-moral, operated on the base of a pre-existing psychology which attached little importance to the welfare of the individual or to his personality.
I'm sure you would agree with me that the tendency to scapegoat from that period was obviously also an important factor. And I dare say most Russians wouldn't, and I think I don't call that period a reform period. Maybe there was some intention at Jeffrey Sachs' level to have a reform, but a lot of it was just sort of Wild West exploitation and getting what you could get, and it wasn't exclusively by the oligarchs over there. There was certainly a part of it which was willing participation by various corporations and individuals from this side of the former curtain. Thank you.
Yeah. You want to follow up on that?
Well, I think that there was some, there were corrupt ties to people in the West. I mean, a lot of what happened in Russia could not have been done without the cooperation of Western partners who were involved in corrupt practices.
About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is David Satter. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He's teaching a course on contemporary Russian politics and the media. He's a journalist. He covered Moscow and the Soviet Union for the Financial Times for a number of years and has also written extensively for the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. His articles have also appeared at other places as well, including LA Times, National Review, New Republic, New York Review of Books, Washington Times. He's also authored two books on Russia. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. For at least a little while now, in a lot of the mainstream coverage of Russia, there has been a great focus on Vladimir Putin and what happens when he stepped down from the presidency, which he is due to do next year. The presidency in Russia is term limited by the Constitution, so assuming that he follows the rules, he'll be stepping aside. And for some time, the question was, well, you know, what happens? What's he going to do? No one apparently expected he was just going to retire from politics. And now it appears that what's going to happen is that he'll become a member of the Duma, the Russian parliament. And in fact, he is expected to become the prime minister, which has been not a particularly powerful position. But I think now everyone expects that's going to be different if Mr. Putin is the prime minister. He's picked somebody to be the next president. And it seemed that this suggests, or the way people have talked about it, it suggests that really nothing is going to change, that he's going to continue to be the most influential man in Russian politics as prime minister, and that things will go on as they have. Is that, in fact, the way do you think it's going to be? And I'm thinking particularly about what now you have pointed to in some of your writing, and I think it's maybe one of the first places that I've seen it, the suggestion that infighting among people who are on the top levels of the Kremlin is a serious issue, and that there are people who would challenge Mr. Putin, and we don't necessarily know that things are just going to go along as they have with just a few people changing their, you know, the nameplates that's on their desk.
Yes, I think that the situation is unpredictable, and I think that we can't take it for granted that even though Putin has expressed an interest in becoming prime minister, that that's really going to happen. Hmm. We have to wait and see. I think that the situation, a lot is going on under the surface, but not much of it is visible to us. It used to be that the Soviet leaders were obsessed with power, and I think that the new Russian leaders are obsessed with money and with conspicuous, maybe not with conspicuous consumption, but with money as a symbol of power. Perhaps we could put it that way. I don't think that we should be quick to draw conclusions about whether anything is going to change or not, because the fact is we really have to wait and see. Russia is a very unpredictable country, and it's a system has been created without reliable rules, and in which the passions and the greed of individuals who've acquired wealth beyond the dreams of avarice for largely accidental reasons needs to be there. Those passions need to be taken into account. I think that we'll just have to see what happens as events unfold.
Hmm. Well, there. Before we got to this point, where he named his choice for successor as president, and at least we get this one particular scenario that says he continues to be involved in politics and continues to be very important, but with a different job. I mean, people were speculating about all kinds of things that might happen. Everything from the fact that he would step down for just long enough, could come back, because there's nothing that says you couldn't be president again as long as somebody else is president for a while. The people have talked about the possibility that he could engineer actually some change in the Russian constitution to get rid of the term limit, and or that there would be some kind of national emergency, real or provoked, that would give him the opportunity to say, well, you know, I don't think this is a very good time for me to be leaving. I think I'd better stay. You know, at least those kinds of scenarios, and maybe there are others. Of those things, when you think about everything that has been tossed out there as possible, is there anything that you think is more likely than anything else? Or is there yet something else that you think? And here, I know I'm asking you just to speculate.
I think it's very hard to. Of course, one is tempted to say that the most likely development is that not much will change. Hmm. Because a lot of people have a stake in the status quo. It's possible that that's what we will indeed witness, especially if oil prices stay high. But I'm cautious. I'm cautious because I think there's a lot we don't know. And I think there's a lot that can still happen. There was there's infighting in the security services, which is potentially very dangerous. And what they're fighting about is hard to say because they're it's not that not over political principles, that's for sure, because the commercial activities of the members of the security services are well known. It's really over money, business, a share of the, you know, the dividing up the pie. But nonetheless, the animosities that are engendered by in that situation are, at least according to the reports that we get in the West, are just as extreme as they would be if people were really fighting over something of substance. Hmm. So I think we just have to wait and see. Perhaps the odds are that there won't be big changes, but nonetheless, in a country like Russia, where so little is known about the workings of the higher levels of power, surprises cannot be excluded.
So is it correct to say that for people who would be seeking political power at a high level in Russia, that they would a lot of them are motivated by the fact that accumulating political power is a means to accumulate wealth?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And wealth is a means to accumulate
political power. And can you break those two things apart? I would think that if what you were really interested in was wealth, you wouldn't
bother. Yeah, the people – I think it's more right now in the present situation, those who are in power use – their positions to accumulate wealth. Those who are wealthy simply try to mollify the political authorities because, as we saw in the Khodorkovsky case, you can be the richest man in Russia, but if you alienate the political authorities, your future is not protected. So that may, but there's no question that political power is the path to great wealth, and there's no better example of this apparently than Putin, who, according to some reports, has amassed a personal fortune of $40 billion. That's more than a lot of governments have.
Mm. This is, I think, when Robert Amsterdam was here the other day talking about the Khodorkovsky case, he mentioned that, and again, this is another one of those things that I'm not sure that I haven't read enough or haven't read the right things that I have. Heard that Mr. Putin himself has managed to accumulate personally such a significant fortune.
Well, there's been material about this in the press. There's a guy in Moscow by the name of Stanislav Belkovsky, who apparently has, and here again is another example of the infighting that's going on. He has connections to the security services, and he is putting out this information, and he's been quoted in major newspapers, and he's given very precise information and very precise figures. Is it plausible? Well, there are some indications that it is, and in fact, it would be totally in character for a Russian or Soviet leader. Gorbachev also was not modest about accumulating the palace that he built for himself in Foros in the Crimea. Was something out of 1001 Arabian Nights. So the unlimited greed of people who don't have principles is not something that we should take lightly.
Hmm. Well, if it, again, I realize we're dealing in speculation, but. If someone else was to emerge as the focus of power other than Mr. Putin, would that, do you think, make a great deal of difference in terms of Soviet policy, economic policy? Of Russian policy, either Russian domestic policy, Russian foreign policy. You know, would that really would things change in that way, or would it, again, just be a matter of we'd be talking about somebody – we've been talking about somebody different at the high table, and policy really wouldn't change.
That's hard to say. We don't know. We don't really know. Medvedev is Putin's handpicked successor, so we can assume that policy won't change much. But on the other hand, events drive policy, and we don't know what's likely to happen in Russia over the next year or two. There could be dramatic events which will force all kinds of changes. We just don't know.
What does that mean, do you think, for the United States? And I, here, I guess, what I'm really thinking of is the relationship between the two governments.
Well, the situation that we have now is one in which the Russian authorities do feel the fragility of the situation. Partially, it's because of their own paranoia, I suspect. And they were also spooked by the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, where the population actually rejected an attempt to foist an unpopular ruler on them and someone who had not won the election. They're not used to the population expressing itself in that way and forcing the leadership to make changes. So I think that we just have to be cautious in our assessments. Medvedev, who is likely to be the president, is the handpicked successor to Putin. But people, when they get supreme power, if in fact Medvedev gets that power, aren't necessarily permanently constrained by their allegiance to one or another person who helped them to achieve that power. So we may see a situation in which there's actually the development of what the Russians refer to as dual power. And in Russia, a country where there's no tradition of that, that could become dangerous. Medvedev and Putin are friends, but how reliable is that friendship under the strains of the competition for money and power that life at the top of the Russian political pyramid involves? So this we just don't know.
For a lot of reasons. The government of the United States, particularly, and I guess I'm thinking of the Bush administration, has wanted to have a positive, constructive relationship with Russia.
Well, we have every reason to want that,
and we should, and obviously we should want that. I guess I'm thinking about those people who argue that in wanting to have Russian, in a sense, cooperation with the agenda of the United States, particularly its foreign policy agenda, that we have, by seeking their cooperation and giving them a pass on some things, that ultimately I know I'm asking the question very bad. Ultimately, we're not doing ourselves any favors. That in fact, there are ways in which the Russians work against American interest, and that we turn a blind eye to that because perhaps there are some areas where they say, well, they're being cooperative. Particularly when it comes to our concerns about global terrorism. And I wonder overall the relationship between the two countries, to what extent you could say that Russian policy it benefits us or doesn't benefit us?
Well, it doesn't benefit us at the present time because they haven't been cooperative on a whole range of issues, including sanctions for Iran. Russian weapons were used by Hezbollah in the war in southern Lebanon with Israel to deadly effect against Israeli tanks. And those weapons were transshipped from Syria, but the Russians almost surely knew about it. Now they've moved in or are threatening to move in extremely high-tech anti-aircraft missiles into Iran to protect Iran's nuclear facilities. Well, that makes a strike by either Israel or the United States more likely rather than less. And, of course, it embitters those in the West who are concerned about Iran. So Russia is, you know, acting in a way that is wide range of issues on a way that is contrary to the interests of the United States. And it was our hope that by muting our criticism of Russia's human rights practices and its anti-democratic evolution, that we could get more cooperation than we have gotten. So it could be said that our silence and self-censorship has really brought us no positive result. And maybe it would have been better just to speak our minds openly in the hope that at least in the long run we would build up moral capital with the Russian population, for one thing. And for another, we would offer some resistance to the tendencies which are leading Russia in an anti-Western direction.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, David Satter, will be giving a talk this afternoon on the Soviet Gulag at 4 in room 1080 of the Foreign Languages Building. That's the Lucy Ellis Lounge, and that's at 707 South Matthews in Urbana. He's here this semester on the campus of the University of Illinois teaching a course on contemporary Russian politics and the media. He was a former Moscow correspondent of the Financial Times, continues to write for the Wall Street Journal. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. His work also appears in other places, has appeared National Review, New Republic, New York Review of Books, Washington Times, and LA Times. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.